Hi, I'm Doug Gordon. Welcome back to Beta from Wisconsin Public Radio. Chris Nashawaty is a writer, editor, and a former film critic for Entertainment Weekly. His latest book is called The Future Was Now: Mad Men, Mavericks, and the Epic Sci-Fi Summer of 1982. And while the summer of 69 may have been the best days of my fellow Canadian Bryan Adams, those days cannot compare to what happened in the summer of 82. That's when Hollywood caught a serious case of science fiction fever. 8 sci-fi movies, including E.T., Tron, and Star Trek II: The Wrath of Khan, were released within 8 weeks of one another. The release of these movies changed the career paths of some of Tinseltown's biggest stars and filmmakers, like Steven Spielberg, Ridley Scott, and John Carpenter. This was a huge turning point in the history of Hollywood. Chris joins us now to talk about what was in the water that resulted in so many classic and cult classic films to be released at the same time.
In terms of what was in the water is two words, Star Wars. Mm-hmm. You know, that came out in the summer of 1977. And as a result, it was really an unexpected phenomenon. And, you know, science fiction was sort of still regarded as a corny genre for nerdy kids, and the Hollywood studios weren't very interested in catering to them. But when Star Wars came out, you know, they quickly realized that there was gold with this audience, and they decided all the studios hustled a science fiction movie into production or, you know, development. And, you know, obviously that takes time, and that all sort of culminates in the summer of 1982.
Yeah. And did you know this before you started writing your book, that there were all these 8 films? Were you aware of this interesting fact, or did that kind of come up as you were writing the book?
I was writing an article for Esquire magazine, which I occasionally write for, about movies. It was an anniversary piece about June 25th, 1982. And that was the day that both Blade Runner and The Thing opened on the same day, which is hard to fathom. And they were both sort of dismissed by critics. Blade Runner did okay commercially, but The Thing really tanked. And to me, what was interesting is how those movies are now sort of like part of the sci-fi canon. They're sort of acknowledged masterpieces of the genre. And back then, they weren't. And that sort of evolution sent me digging into 1982. And as I was digging, I was like, holy moly, look at all of these movies that came out, you know, just literally week after week after week. So it really snowballed, but it started off with those two movies.
Thank you. It's great to hear the origin story of the book. I was very curious. You raised this very intriguing question in your book that I would like to quote. And the question is, what happens when a niche genre on the fringes of mass entertainment becomes the most dominant force in mass entertainment? What's the answer to your question?
Well, I think, you know, it can start off good, but as we see now, you know, it can lead to some sort of not great results. I think that the lessons learned from that summer 40-something years ago, you know, are good and bad. On the one hand, you know, we saw a real renaissance in genre filmmaking, and these audiences that were really hungry for new movies and to get their minds blown, you know, were, in the immediate aftermath, treated to a lot of great movies. The problem is that when you make movies for fans and you go for that blockbuster mentality, trying to recreate Star Wars, what happens is you start making a lot of sequels. You follow the movies that make the most money with more of the same. And the movies that don't fall into that genre sort of fall through the cracks. So, you know, that is why in the summer of 2024, we're getting a lot of superhero movies and sequels, but we're not getting a lot of great movies for original movies for grown-ups, or, you know, terrific comedies that you got in 1982, like Tootsie. You just don't see that kind of movie being really made anymore.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. Let's talk about the groundbreaking movie Tron. It was written and directed by a guy named Steven Lisberger. Where does Steven get the idea for Tron?
Steven Lisberger was an animator coming out of Boston. He ran this little studio that was, you know, sort of populated by hipster hippies who were still sort of the Woodstock generation, and they sort of thought about movies a little bit differently and filmmaking a little bit differently. Lisberger was a big fan of the video game sort of boom that was happening in the late 70s, early 80s with, you know, starting with Pong, but going to Space Invaders and then Asteroids. I'm sure you remember them all. But he was really into that. And I think that his background in animation, cutting edge animation and video games, he sort of put those two ideas together and thought, you know, what if I did this really cool, almost computer generated movie that's sort of a combination of live action and animation and set it in the world of video games.
Come on, big fella, let's see what you got.
I'd like to go against you and see what you're made of.
You know, you don't look a thing like your pictures.
I'm warning you. You're entering a big era, Flynn. I'm gonna have to put you on the game, Brid.
Game? You want games? I'll give you games.
It's really a movie that was tremendously ahead of its time. You know, it's not my favorite movie, but there's no denying the sort of indelible impact it made at the time. I don't think you have something like Pixar today without it.
Yeah, and it's interesting that it came from Disney, Walt Disney Studios.
Exactly. And it's also worth remembering that Disney at the time was not the Disney of today. I mean, today it's got, you know, it's got Star Wars, it's got Pixar, it's got, you know, Lucasfilms and Marvel, and it's just this behemoth now. But in the early 80s, Disney was really sort of, you know, a sleepy place that was on its last legs. You know, Walt Disney had passed away in 1966, and it was really sort of leaderless and rudderless. They didn't know where to go. They were just re-releasing these old animated movies every summer. And I don't know that, you know, had they not adapted to these new times the way they did with a willingness to take risks, that they'd even be around today.
Absolutely. Very well said. Chris, one of the films released during this, whatever you want to call it, bonanza of science fiction films was Star Trek II, The Wrath of Khan. This has become probably the most beloved Star Trek film. What was the critical reaction to it?
I think, you know, it's interesting. The critics were really favorable on it. But I think part of the reason they were so enthusiastic about it was, A, it's a great movie for a Star Trek movie, and B, it was coming on the heels of the first Star Trek movie, Star Trek The Motion Picture from 1979, which was a dud. It was just big and self-important and not a lot of fun, and it focused more on effects than it did on, you know, the characters that we had been sort of hoping to see return since the TV show went off the air. And it emphasized all the wrong things and was a real disappointment to both, you know, the studio and the fans. So, you know, when Star Trek II came along, it was really a last-ditch attempt to save this franchise.
I don't like to lose.
Then you never faced that situation. Face death.
I don't believe in the no-win scenario. Kirk to Spock, it's 2 hours. Are you ready?
Right on schedule, Admiral. Just give us your coordinates and we'll beam you aboard.
All right. I don't like to lose.
They needed it to succeed. They needed a good movie. Otherwise, you know, I don't think we'd still be talking about Star Trek today. It was really, Star Trek II: The Wrath of Khan was the movie that really saved Star Trek.
Mm-hmm. And correct me if I'm wrong, but Leonard Nimoy did not participate in the first Star Trek movie, correct?
No, he did. It was an unpleasant experience for him. And I think he's always had a bit of a love-hate relationship with Spock. Obviously, it's as a lot of actors do with these iconic characters. You both appreciate what they've done for your career, but also in a way sort of resent them a little bit because you've been pigeonholed. And I think that, you know, he, especially after how dismal the first Star Trek movie was, I don't think he was in any rush to return to make a sequel. But they sort of tantalized him with this idea of how would you feel about having a great death scene? This whole idea of Spock dying in the second film was really an appeal to his vanity as an actor. Like, how would you love this great scene to go out on? And he really liked that idea, which is the only reason really he came back.
And that was leaked to the press, wasn't it, before the movie was released, wasn't it?
Yeah. I mean, this was really as top secret as you could possibly get on the Paramount lot, was this idea that Star Trek II was going to be the movie where they killed off Spock. It was, needless to say, something that fans were not excited about.
Of my friend, I can only say this. Of all the souls I have encountered in my travels, his was the most human.
It certainly created a lot of attention for the movie, but they wanted to keep it under wraps. And it was leaked. But when I spoke to the director, Nicholas Meyer, he suspects that it was Gene Roddenberry, the creator of Star Trek, who was the one who leaked it, because Roddenberry had sort of been iced out of the movies after the first one because of some difficulties with the studio. And so I think he was unhappy about that and he was stung by it and decided to maybe sabotage the film a little bit. This is all alleged and it's all, you know, from Meyer, but it makes a lot of sense. If his intention was to sabotage the film, it backfired because this whole idea of Spock dying in the film created an enormous amount of anticipation and excitement for the movie and helped turn it into, you know, a very, very successful film.
Mm-hmm. I was very interested to learn about John Carpenter's making of The Thing based on the short story Who Goes There by John Wood Campbell Jr. What was it about Campbell's story that intrigued Carpenter?
Well, I think that, you know, Carpenter grew up as a real, sci-fi nerd. And, he read everything. He saw all of the, you know, famous 50s science fiction pictures, including The Thing from Another World, which was the first movie that was made out of Wood's story. I think the thing that was so great about the story is that the same reason why a lot of people talked about rewatching The Thing during the pandemic. This is a movie with a real allegory that it's almost like a shapeshifter like The Thing. It can adapt to any moment in the culture, whether it's AIDS, whether it's, you know, the pandemic, whether it's about, you know, paranoia or mistrust with the government. All of these things, they're really good metaphors for the movie.
Every little piece is an individual animal with a built-in desire to protect its own life. You see, when a man bleeds, it's just tissue. No blood from one of you things won't obey when it's attacked. It'll try and survive.
So I think that that's really, in the 50s, when the first movie came out, it was sort of a nice allegory for McCarthyism and communism and, you know, the enemy walks among us, right? But in the 80s, you know, there were a number of things that could have been a stand-in for. And it continues, you know, with each new sort of cultural moment, it feels relevant again.
How did The Thing do at the box office?
It was a disaster. Of all the movies that are covered in this book, The Thing, which is probably my favorite of these movies, is the one that fared the worst at the box office. It's funny, you know, in 1982, the mood of the country, Reagan was newly in office, peddling this idea of optimism for the country and patriotism, and the country was coming off of Vietnam and Watergate, and I don't think that they were in the mood for a downbeat movie, which I think is why in the summer of 1982, the biggest success story was E.T., sort of a shiny, happy, fuzzy science fiction movie, and the biggest bomb was the one that's the, you know, the most downbeat and cynical. So that's my guess. But the results of it were that, you know, it really put a bit of a hiccup in the director John Carpenter's career at the time. He is on a magnificent run at the time with things like Halloween and Escape from New York, a lot of great movies. You know, his star was rising. And then when this movie came out, he was, you know, treated like a criminal.
Mm-hmm. Didn't they cut whichever the studio was, said no more movies, and they kicked him out of his office?
right, exactly.
Yeah, yeah, I felt really bad when I read about that because, as you pointed out, he was doing really well, like just based on Halloween alone.
Yeah, exactly.
It's a huge hit, yeah. Of course, The Thing suffered from being released so close to another alien film, which you mentioned, E.T. This has to be the undisputed winner of the summer of 82, right?
Yeah, and maybe the winner of the 80s as a decade. I mean, it really, it was a movie that was more than a movie. It was an event. It was like a pop cultural sort of religious experience. It's hard to fathom if you didn't live through it, but it really infiltrated and saturated the culture.
We could be happy here. I could take care of you. I wouldn't let anybody hurt you. We could grow up together, E.T.
It's obviously a great movie, but when it came out, I think it was number one for 16 non-consecutive weeks. I mean, it really played, you know, through the end of the year. It was nominated for Oscars. You know, it became the top grossing movie of all time. It really was, you know, as big as you could possibly get.
Yeah, I think you're probably right. I think I know the answer to this next question, but I'm going to ask it anyway. You knew this was coming. Of the 8 films you covered, I'm sending you to a desert island with a Blu-ray player and only one of the 8 films. Which one are you choosing?
Oh, God. If you had asked me when I was 13, which I was in the summer of 1982, I would have said E.T. But as a grown-up who's watched these movies quite a bit and is still finding new things in them, I think I would choose The Thing just because it's a movie that I keep finding more in every time I watch it. There's something to me about that movie that feels like comfort food. I throw it on a lot when I'm I don't know what I want to watch. I just throw that on as sort of my default backup thing. So, yeah, I would go with that.
Mm-hmm. Yes, I knew you would because you had mentioned that earlier. Chris Nashawaty, thank you very much for joining us today. Congratulations on The Future Was Now, Mad Men, Mavericks, and the epic sci-fi summer of 1982. It's a beautifully written and very meticulously researched book that is perfect for all of those cinephiles out there.
Thank you very much.
Chris Nashawaty is the author of The Future Was Now, Mad Men, Mavericks, and the epic sci-fi summer of 1982. Find out more at wpr.org/beta. Well, that does it for this edition of Beta. Thanks to our guests, Simon Rich, Helen Phillips, and Chris Nashawaty.
What you're gleaning from these interviews is groundbreaking.
Beta is available on Apple Podcasts or wherever you catch your favorite pods. Make sure to subscribe and leave a rating. And you can keep up with us during the week or listen to past episodes on our show page at wpr.org/beta.
Even for the internet, it's pretty shocking.
Beta is a production of Wisconsin Public Radio and Red Me Productions.
Fantastic.
Our technical director and producer is Steve Gotcher.
He tasks me and I shall have him.
Our executive producer is Adam Friedrich.
And thus begins his meteoric rise to, what is he now, executive VP?
And thanks to you, our alphas. More Beta comes your way next week. Until then, I'm Doug Gordon.
What would your world be without me?